Businesses Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, Sophia Henderson Holmes memorializes the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire.
Now, the latest workplace tragedy. The explosion last Wednesday at the Texas Chemical and Fertilizer plant left at least 14 people dead and more than 160 injured. In the last year, on average, 4,500 people died in workplace accidents.
But while the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, has jurisdiction over 7 million workplaces in the U.S., spent only $558 million a year, an increasing number of workers died. With a gutted agency, it's not uncommon for some companies to go years without inspection.
The Texas plant hadn't been inspected since 1985, and even then, despite being cited by serious violations for storage of anhydrous ammonia, was fined a mere $30. Now we speak with Tom O'Connor, Executive Director of the National Council on Occupational Safety and Health. Well, Texas on fire again and again, a deadly plant blast that was really waiting to happen. I do recall with a little bit of research that in 1947, in the Gulf Coast community called Texas City, there were several hundred-pound bags of ammonium nitrate fertilizer that were on fire in a ship down in the waterfront. So it would appear that very little was done in terms of viewing the storage of fertilizer and chemicals as an industrial accident waiting to happen. And it's quite remarkable that there weren't more workers in the plant, to our knowledge in any event at this juncture, that were killed. So contextualize for us what did happen in Texas and why we should view this as part of what is happening nationally in terms of a greater number of industrial workplace accidents.
Yeah, you point to back to the terrible tragedy from Texas City in 1947, but what was brought to mind to me was the Bhopal incident in the 1980s and how that tragic chemical disaster in India led us to develop a system that was supposed to prevent exactly what just happened.
That was the Union Carbide gas explosion that killed thousands.
Right, and after that, you know, we said, hey, this could happen here in the United States. We need to institute a system to prevent this. So we created this Emergency Planning and Community Right to Know Act, which was supposed to ensure that people in the community surrounding a plant that stored dangerous chemicals, and that particularly firefighters and emergency personnel, knew very well where there were large quantities of hazardous materials stored, so that if there was a fire and they were called on to respond to a fire, they would know in advance, hey, this place could blow up catastrophically. And in this case, they clearly did not know that. They ran out there doing, you know, responding to the call of duty, doing their job, responding to this fire with no idea that this was a place that had 100 times the amount of explosives that Timothy McVeigh used to blow up the federal building in Oklahoma City. So that was a catastrophic failure of that regulatory system. And the other part of that failure was the fact that, you know, I tried to look up and see what the OSHA inspection record of this company was, and I was shocked to find no records of any OSHA activity at the plant going back all the way to 1985. They were inspected once, found to have a serious violation of some sort, and were fined a total of $30. So we have a big problem in terms of the underfunding of our enforcement agencies. OSHA, EPA, both of those agencies should have known something about what was going on at this plant, and neither one of them did, and neither one of them followed up on some information that had come out that this plant was storing a large quantity of hazardous materials.
In fact, the plant notified the EPA that there was no danger of an explosion, and they were fined in $2,000 fine by the EPA for faulty record keeping. I mean, there's numerous agencies that are involved in this, including the fact that they were supposed to report this to the Department of Homeland Security when they had large quantities of nitrous material. So how can they be so far under the radar screen for so many agencies for so long?
Yeah, that's a great question, Ken. And, you know, we continually are hearing from certain people in Washington these days about job-killing regulations, and we don't need any more regulation. We need government to stay out of the way of business and making profit. But we've learned in this case that that's exactly what happened with it, that all of the responsible agencies were out of the way, and as a result, we had a terrible catastrophic incident where the lack of regulation and the lack of enforcement led to workers and people in the community being killed. And that's why we have safeguards of public health and safety. That's why we say we need a stronger EPA, a stronger OSHA, in order to have the resources to inspect these facilities. The EPA received some information that turned out to be completely false about what the risks of this plant were. As you said, they indicated that they were very low risk, and in fact, they had a huge quantity of extremely explosive material on site. The EPA never followed up on that, I imagine for lack of resources. So we have a system where our government agencies are underfunded. For OSHA to try to cover the state of Texas with its few inspectors that it has, it would take about 100 years for them to inspect every workplace in Texas once. So it's not a surprise that that plant was under the radar. But it is very disturbing that they were able to fall through the cracks with that amount of extremely explosive material that's used to make bombs around the world.
In the wake of the Upper Big Branch, a mine explosion in 2010 that killed 29 miners, now, for the first time in U.S. history, no safety legislation was passed to fix the problems. It's quite incredible. And for nearly 2 years now, the White House Office of Management and Budget has blocked from public view workplace safety rules proposed by OSHA concerning cancer-causing silica dust. So flesh out more how we are to understand and relate to this complete lack of immersion in the federal government to deal with the not only greater number, but the far more deadly level of accidents that occur within the workplace.
After the Upper Big Branch mine disaster, we thought, hey, this is a time when absolutely Congress is going to take action to address the problem of mine safety because it's so obviously needed and there will be a response. And, you know, there were many senators and Congress people pounding their desks saying we need action on mine safety. Then bills were introduced. There was a lot of talking, a lot of posturing, and nothing happened. And here we are still talking about it and nothing happening. So that's been extremely frustrating with both the lack of ability of the Congress to take action on anything, but also a general reluctance to do anything in terms of any new regulation that would be seen as, you know, imposing any new requirements on business. And that silica standard, as you said, silica is a cancer-causing dust that many workers and many industries are exposed to. OSHA's been trying to improve regulations on that for some 20 years. The rule has been stuck at the Office of Management and Budget for 2 years, and it's our understanding that there are people within the Obama administration that don't want to see this move forward because they don't want to be seen as being in favor of more regulation on business. Safeguards like this are necessary to protect the public health and safety, and we only learn that lesson when there's a disaster.
The budget for the Occupational Safety and Health Administration is only about $550 million. Is there any move in Congress at all to rectify the situation?
We've been trying to strengthen the OSHA budget for years without much success, but no, the idea of increasing OSHA's budget for enforcement has not been popular. And I would think that some of these cases would demonstrate that OSHA is just vastly underfunded and incapable of meeting its goal of ensuring that all workplaces are safe and healthy.
There are roughly 4,500 Americans a year, on average, who die in workplace accidents, which, again, is an extraordinary number. And yet, we can spend the billions on anti-terrorist procedures and so on. And as Ben mentioned, there's a mere $550 million a year spent on OSHA. I don't know how many hundreds of thousands of work sites they are supposed to inspect and protect the workers in. So what is the recalcitrance? What do we not know publicly that has created more of a hue and cry to bring this agency, which I don't even know if we can say it's gutted, because it certainly has never been funded as it should be, but what has been the reluctance to push this agency where it needs to go to protect the workers of this country, such as in the case of the Texas explosion?
Yeah, that's a great question, great point, Mimi, that we tend to notice these workplace hazards, fatalities, only when they come in great numbers, such as in this case in West Texas. But the 14 people who died in that terrible tragedy, that represents the number of people who die every day in a workplace accident. These are not things that get a lot of attention because they happen, you know, one at a time. Somebody who falls off a roof and dies because they didn't have adequate protection. Somebody who dies in a trench cave-in. Someone who's killed in a workplace violence incident. These kind of things happen, you know, every day. But they don't get the public's attention as they do when there's a major catastrophe. And I think that just generally the public is not aware of the extent of this problem, and that's why we are trying to bring attention to it through our Workers' Memorial Day events that we do every year around April 28th, and doing a week of action around this anniversary where we're going to be trying to get public attention to this issue and for the need for stronger enforcement of workplace safety and health laws to try to prevent those deaths that happen every day, not just when there's a catastrophic incident.
In many cases, the OSHA responds to complaints initiated by workers or unions. So what is the role of unions in OSHA enforcement, and how important are they?
Unions play a very important role in adequate OSHA enforcement because, as you suggested, most workers, union and non-union, are afraid to report safety hazards to OSHA because they believe that they will be retaliated against. And, I mean, it's pretty shocking that even union workers who've been working 20 years, 25 years at a plant are afraid to report hazards to OSHA. Imagine the non-union temporary worker, for example, who's in a very precarious employment situation. They're never going to report hazards to OSHA. So the unions have played a fundamental role in providing real protections for workers who speak up about safety and health hazards. And, you know, the decline in union membership in this country has meant that fewer and fewer workers every year feel safe and comfortable to report hazards to OSHA, and as a result, they are subject to increasing levels of hazards on the job. The other point I wanted to make about that is that not only is OSHA lacking in adequate enforcement personnel, but when they do come into a plant and they find violations, the fines are so paltry that it just does not act as any kind of a deterrent effect for a company who has unsafe conditions. I mean, even in the case of a worker death, the average fine that OSHA imposes is only about $7,000. So those small fines just are not sufficient to protect workers and prevent future disasters. We've been trying to get the OSHA Act amended for years to allow OSHA more leeway in imposing greater fines and criminal penalties in really egregious cases where an employer willfully exposes workers to extremely hazardous conditions. Right now, if that happens, the Department of Justice can only prosecute the employer for a misdemeanor, like a traffic ticket. We would like to see that change so that an employer who puts workers at risk of their lives can be prosecuted for a felony. And right now that's not possible under the OSHA Act.
And, of course, we can go back and recall that there were as many as 458 safety violations that were recorded prior to the explosion at the Upper Big Branch mine. And we can get 360,000 Americans who have been killed on the job since 1970. And more recently, we hear these massive drowning deaths, if you will, in grain elevators, where there's virtually no publicity or response to. So what do we do? Is there any legislation pending? Is there any kind of push from any congressional figures, et cetera, to really strengthen the funding and to take the issues of workers' health and safety seriously?
There is legislation that's been reintroduced called the Protecting America's Workers Act. In the Senate, Senator Patty Murray has sponsored that. In the House, it was just introduced this week by Representative George Miller. That legislation would allow OSHA greater leeway for more significant fines in cases that are egregious. It would strengthen these protections for whistleblowers, people who report safety hazards to OSHA and are afraid of losing their job, and in many ways would strengthen the OSHA Act, would allow for criminal penalties, for example, in cases of extreme negligence. So that legislation is out there. You know, we have to say we're not optimistic about it, given the current anti-regulatory nature of the House in particular, but those solutions are out there, and if Congress wants to act to protect workers, that legislation is there, and we'd like to see them take action on it.
Tom, you're the executive director of the National Council for Occupational Safety and Health, and I know there are numerous more local bodies for occupational safety and health throughout the country. Can you describe your work and the work of these several state and local bodies and whether that's a good place for people who are not in unions and those, or maybe those also who are in unions, to find out more about OSHA regulations and also about whether they're being impacted by unsafe conditions?
Yeah, we have a network of about 20 local and statewide organizations around the country called COSH groups, Committees or Coalitions on Occupational Safety and Health, that provide information to workers, both union and non-union, about their rights on the job and how to protect their health and safety on the job. These groups can help workers file OSHA complaints if necessary, can provide them information about hazards on the job. One of our strongest groups is in New York City, NYCOSH, nycosh.org. It's a great website and great information if anybody wants needs assistance with addressing workplace health and safety issues. NYCOSH is a great organization that I would encourage people to get in touch with. I wanted to go back to a point that you made, Mimi, about the grain elevator hazards. I mean, that was one of the most tragic series of events in the last couple of years, has been this spate of young workers in particular getting killed in grain elevators. There was a case back in July 2010 that we highlight in our report where there were three young men. The youngest was only 14 years old. Wyatt Whitebread in Mount Carroll, Illinois, and his two friends were working in a grain elevator, and they were told when the grain gets wet and sticky, workers are often told to walk the grain, walk on the top of it and try to scrape it and allow it to flow. But that's a practice that OSHA has been telling these operators for years is extremely dangerous. And what can happen and what did happen in this case is that it creates a sort of quicksand effect. And these three young men, boys even, were swallowed up by the grain, and only one of them was rescued alive. So there's been this pattern of these terrible grain elevator incidents. OSHA keeps sending letters to every operator of these grain elevators around the country, telling them about these hazards, telling them that they have to practice certain safety practices to avoid this, and yet this keeps happening. And we saw some proposed regulations last summer from the Department of Labor to limit youth work in agriculture in certain hazardous jobs. And we got such a backlash from the agribusiness lobby, just pulled out all the stops and forced the Department of Labor to pull back that proposal and to essentially promise that they would never bring it up again. So we've got, once again, a big fight on our hands with some of the industry advocates for fewer and fewer regulations, and as a result, seeing more and more young workers dying and getting injured on the job.
Tom, to find out more about this and other hazards on the jobs and what people can do about it, do you want to give us your website to where they can also, I assume, get
yeah,
the website?
Yeah, it's www.koshnetwork, koshnetwork.org. That's our national organization website.
And people can go online and get the report, Preventable Deaths, the Tragedy of Workplace Fatalities, which has been authored in preparation, really, for Workers' Memorial Day by National Kosh. Tom O'Connor, Executive Director of National Kosh, thank you for joining us.
The Triangle Fire, an extraordinary poem commemorating March 25, 1911, where 146 young immigrant workers died in a tragic fire at the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory in New York. And we go to the poem by Safiya Henderson Holmes.
From bareness to fullness, flowers do bloom. Whenever, however, spring enters a room. Oh, whenever, however, spring enters a room. March 25th, 1911. At the Triangle Shirtwaist Factory, a fire claimed the lives of 146 people, mostly women, mostly children, in the plume of their lives, in the room of their lives, begging for spring, toiling and begging for spring. And in my head, as I read the history, afraid to touch the pictures, I imagined the room. I imagined the women, dressed in pale blues and pinks, some without heads or arms, sitting, some without legs or waists, hovering. Hundreds of flowering girls, tucking spring into sleeves, tucking and tugging at spring to stay alive. Shirtwaist Factory Room, 1911. Crowded, hard, fast, too fast, closed windows, locked doors, smell of sweat, of wishes being cut to bits, needle stabs, electric shocks, miscarriages over silk, fading paisley, fading magenta, falling in love will get you fired. Forever old, never fast enough, buying flowers is wasteful, so hurry, hurry, grind your teeth and soul, $6 a week sent to grandfather, $4 a week sent to Aunt Ruth, sleep over the machine and you're done for, way before you open your eyes, ma'am, madam, miss, Mrs. Mother, girlie, hundreds of flowering green spring girls in rows, waiting with needles in hands for spring to show. Women workers from Ireland, Poland, Germany, France, England, Grenada, Mississippi, thin clothes, thinner hopes, months full of why, of how, of when, answers always less than their pay, but the sewing machines grew like weeds, thick snake roots, strangling the flowers every day, strangling the roses, daisies, lilies every day, hundreds of blooming girls, hundreds of blooming spring girls. The Shirtwaist Building, 1911, 135 feet high, wooden, coal, three floors, not enough stairs, one fire escape, ending in mid-air, ending in the spring mid-air, a tender room of hundreds of blooming bright girls, hundreds of daisy bud girls, who pray for spring to enter their world, who pray and sweat for spring to enter their world. The strike the year before. And they shouted, "Open the doors, unwire the windows, more air, more stairs, more quiet time, more fire escapes, and to the ground, damn you, and more toilets, more time to be sick, more time to be well, and remove the fear, and slow it down, for God's sake." "It's spring," they shouted. "Hundreds of flowering girls, hundreds of flowering girls," shouted, "for spring to hurry, hurry, and enter their world." And Triangle won a half day, but the doors remained locked, windows remained wired, no extra air, no extra quiet time or sick time. The fear stayed, nothing slowed, and God watched. Hundreds of flowering girls twirl, hundreds of flowering girls willow and twirl. March 25th, 1911, at Triangle. Smoke, smoke, stopping the machines. Run to wired windows. Run to locked doors. Run to the one and only fire escape. Everyone, run to the air. Hundreds of flowering girls. Smoke, stopping eyes, stopping hearts, stopping worlds. Elevator, move faster. Elevator, you are a machine managed by a human being. Move faster. Come on, faster. Carry all the flowering girls. Carry all the sweet, sweet orchid girls. Fire, catching bouquets of girls in a corner. Tall, long-stemmed lilies on fire in a corner. From bloom to ashes in a corner. Smell them in the rain. Hundreds of tulip girls. On a window ledge, pliés for life. On a window ledge, lovely ribboned young ladies on their tiptoes, twirling, twirling, an arabesque for life. Hundreds of flowering girls, smell them in the rain. Hundreds of jasmine girls. The ladders were too short. The hoses were too short. The men holding the nets were not gods, only men who never caught or trained to catch falling bodies or falling stars or hundreds of flowering girls, hundreds of carnation bud girls. And the girls were not angels, but girls jumping, not goddesses flying or hovering. They smashed. They broke into large pieces. Smell them in the rain. And the sidewalks opened in shame to meet the flowering girls. The sidewalks opened in such horrible shame to cradle the remains of violets. And the gutters bled for hours, choking on bones, shoes, buttons, ribbons, holy sewing needles. The gutters bled for hours, all the colors of spring, the cool magenta of delicate spring.
And that was poet Safia Henderson Holmes as she read her epic poem commemorating the lives of those who died, with her stirring words and the challenge to organize for workers' rights. This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg
and Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.